the only way I can still be light and still be happy is knowing that there is a crisis. This is my truth. And I'm trying to do with it and I'm act on it. So I think that also in a way that helps me to stay sane. So I think a lot of my activism and work is actually acknowledging, owning my truth. A lot of us actually feel that pain and grief because we are connected with this planet, and it's not nice to see all of these animals burning or all of these extreme climatic events happening. But many of us, we don't even know maybe that what it is that we feel and what's going on in our head. The more and more of us try to not run away from these emotions and this truth, the more possible it will be, the faster it will be we can bring about a change.
Hi, I'm Katharina and this is Klimagerecht. Usually this podcast is in German, but I will do, depending on my guests, some episodes in English from time to time. I work as a journalist with a focus on the climate crisis. And in this podcast, I talk about emotions and the climate crisis and also social aspects of the climate crisis. And I'm very happy to talk to Tani Naushin today. She is a climate justice and degrowth activist. She grew up in Dhaka in Bangladesh, and she studied international and development economics and works now for an NGO called Urgewalt, where she does research for the global coal exit list, which means that she researches about companies and how they are involved in coal activities so that other companies know that they shouldn't invest in those coal companies or financial institutions. For our interview, we met in a park in Berlin, so maybe you will hear some sounds of the street from time to time, but I think it's not too much. I had a look at your Twitter bio, and the first thing you write there is a daughter. What does it mean for you to be a daughter?
I think daughter is the first identity I had, like growing, right? Like coming into this world somehow. And I think that's still the most human or most core of my who I am or how I ground myself in this world. And I'm very proud of, I feel very blessed to be the daughter of my parents. And I think a lot of who they were formed me or made me who I am. Both of them were also activists from an early age. They were both very progressive persons. A lot of my thinking, a lot of my personality, and we often don't understand how much we actually get, but it's also somehow, is at the core of who we are. So I think this also gives me this sense of continuity in this world and who I am and how I connect. So I think that's the most grounding and one of the core identity of me that I carry and I value.
You grew up in Dhaka in Bangladesh, and you wrote on your profile of your work that you were deeply moved by the IPCC reports while you were writing your master thesis. What did you write about?
I was writing about how government social protection policies could support climate change adaptation for people, because climate crisis makes the whole inequality even worse in economic systems. The distribution of wealth is quite bad. And when we put the climate crisis on top of it, we see that it's going to make the situation even worse. And people who do not have enough resources to cope with it, they would struggle. They would be the hardest hit. So that was my initial motivation, to see how the governments can support people to cope with climate change. I focused specifically on Bangladesh. But while writing my master thesis, I also encountered the limit of these efforts. And that's when I realized that no matter how much we do adaptation, if we don't focus on the source of climate crisis and we don't focus on mitigation, it's not going to be enough. And if you look at it, it makes the unfairness or the injustice of the whole situation even clearer to you. And also while writing the master thesis, I first encountered, I read the IPCC reports in depth, and there are all these projections. And one of the projections is one of the most actually very conservative projection that says by 2071, so in 50 years, there wouldn't be any country called Bangladesh because of the sea level rise. And for me, that was also very a difficult moment to read that, to know that if I had kids, if I had a daughter, I wouldn't be able to show her where I grew up, where the country that her grandparents fought for, or all the story and all the history. And it was a very difficult realization to a difficult truth to encounter that, and it was very moving for me. It made me, I started crying in the middle of the night, and it was a lot to deal with. But then that's also what pushed me to then really get active in the whole climate movement in terms of demanding climate action and also reducing carbon emissions and get into the degrowth movement.
Can you describe how that feeling, like how it accompanies you, or how it also maybe changed during that time?
This was at the end of 2017. And at that point, still the climate movement in hasn't been that big. The Greta hadn't happened. XR was not still existing or didn't come out at that point. And it felt very lonely for a while. I think it felt like you think, is there something wrong with me or there's something wrong with the world? It really felt like we were sleepwalking towards a distraction and we were not doing enough. It felt very bizarre. It felt, you would feel cynical, like, am I overreacting? But at the same time, if you read the reports and then you're really like, why isn't people doing enough? Why are we not talking about enough? So it was very hard. It felt lonely. It was difficult. The climate movement was still quite small, I think, compared to what it's now. Then, of course, I reached out and then I found the communities. I connected with the degrowth movement. I was getting involved. And I think over the years, then when one good thing is, of course, in 2018, when Fridays became big and when the XR came out, and then so suddenly you didn't feel alone anymore. At least you didn't feel like crazy. When you talked about this is a problem, you didn't feel like you're one crazy, cynical person or this doomsayer or who's saying this thing. But it helped. It helped a lot, of course. And then you felt more sense of solidarity, more strength to fight. And of course, there's also frustration at COP last year. That was my first COP attending in Madrid.
Tani just mentioned the COP. It stands for Conference of the Parties. And it's how people call the yearly United Nations Climate Change Conference. The next should have been in November 2020 in Glasgow, but unfortunately it was postponed to 2021 because of Corona.
And then when you hear all the discussion and how all the countries are pushing the responsibility on each other, then again you feel how absurd it is and you get angry. So I think this emotion evolves, comes. And then when you see all the destruction, the whole Australia's, the forest fire, and then the Arctic melting, the Himalayas glaciers are reducing and the floods are getting worse each year. In Bangladesh, we see the extreme climatic events are getting more frequent all over the world, not only in Bangladesh, but you see all of that and it feels like a pain. It really is like watching someone very close to you getting sick day by day in front of your eyes, and then you feel like, oh, why are we not doing enough? Why the people close to you know, when you, if you see a friend getting sick and if you knew the reason, you would want to do something, you would want to take action, and then you feel angry as well, like, why aren't we doing enough? And we cannot recreate this is so precious. And that feeling of like something that you know to be so precious, but others, clearly, at least the world leaders, the people who are in charge, are not seeing it this way and not doing enough. I think all of this, it's like so whole range of sadness, grief, anger that evolves over the time. But there are also, of course, moments of joy when you feel connected, when you find people who, like, when you find this conviction, like, no, we will change it, we will fight. And then, so there has been this both sides.
Like right now, there are severe floods in Bangladesh, like more than there were before because of the climate crisis. Are you in contact with people there, or can you describe a bit?
Yeah, so the flood was already worse than in a decade, they're saying. And then there's in 1988, we had a pretty bad flood. It was very severe. And this year's flood, saying, is actually even worse than that one in many ways. So 1/3 of Bangladesh was underwater. And also on top of the whole corona crisis. So it's really, the situation is difficult. I mean, in terms of like for the Bengal region, usually flood is one part of the whole, how you call it, like regular kind of a cycle of a certain region. So flood is also one of the reason why the land has been always so fertile in Bengal, and the crops, we have had very like a wide range of crops growing, and it has always been historically for the last 4,000 or 5,000 years. But at the same time, it was never this bad. And of course, it's getting severe. And we see that in terms of managing the floods and in terms of coping with providing support to people to cope with it. These are all the challenges that is getting worse and worse now these days. So one I mean, my family, personally, my family hasn't been affected because, of course, they live in the capital and these parts hadn't been affected in that way. But a wide range, a lot of the friends and activists who have been taking initiative to support the people who are affected, I am in touch with them. And we as diaspora, we try to send support and help. And this is also in a way, how to say, like in a bleak time, there's also positive things in a way that last month was the highest remittance that ever went in Bangladesh. So you also see how people who live abroad, when they know that there is a crisis, they try to, because when the governments and the systems are failing, civilians are taking initiatives and everybody's trying to support that. I think that's something also very inspiring to see that how much private initiatives are there, civilians are stepping up, and how much work that is being done to really support and reach out to people.
The Global North is responsible for like a big part of the historic emissions and even now emissions. And the Global South is like much more vulnerable to the consequences of the climate crisis. Do you think we talk enough about that issue, like especially in Germany?
I think what you say that Global North is historically responsible for the emission and Global South is disproportionately affected by climate change. Exactly, this concept is the core of climate justice concept, right? And we hear a lot about climate justice, but at the same time, exactly what you say, kind of, there's an implicit already an answer in your question that what I've also personally found in the discussion, we hear the word climate justice a lot, but if we ask what climate justice means, a lot of the people cannot really say it. And in the European context, you would often hear there's more about the intergenerational issue is more prominent, that the older generation is stripping away future from the younger generation. But this whole global or this cross Global North, Global South, which is actually present at the moment that is happening, is often not so present, which is also a pity. But I think it's getting more and more like this is being talked now more and more, and the concept is getting discussed more. So I see a positive change in that direction. But I can say even a year ago, that was not the case. Like we did one workshop where I asked, so how many of us we know the word climate justice or this slogan that we often use? Oh, what do we want? Climate justice. When do we want it now? So most said, yeah, we know it. And then when we asked, so how many of us actually know what it means? Then the hands went down. There were not a lot of people in the room. They really knew what climate justice is. And I think, yeah, that's a very key point that we also should be addressing more actively to make very simple concept like this even prominent and emphasize on why we need to act now, because the crisis is not only in future. It's already happening now. It's unfolding right on this planet in different parts. So it's important that we emphasize it even more and connect our responsibility to it even more.
How would you, like you already said that it would be important to stress it more, how would you like the discussion to be, or what are maybe ways to address it in a better way?
I think the core of the climate justice should always be put first, that it's the people who are responsible for the climate crisis are not the ones who are going to be impacted. There is this disproportionate distribution of the impacts and the responsibility, and there's this justice fact, and then connect it. Clearly, we need to demystify the whole the colonial continuity of climate crisis, that why this climate crisis is not just suddenly one scientific problem. It is a social problem. It is a historical, and that problem has a colonial history as well. And I think we need to make that clear. We need to make those aspects clear. And it's also not so there is a social aspect. There's also an economic aspect, because there was this recent study where they showed that the main problem, because a lot gets says, oh, it's the population that is to blame for the climate crisis. But this concept is also very unfair, because if you look, the people who are responsible for all the carbon emission, it's a small percentage of people, but the people who lives a very affluent life. So the problem, the core is affluence. So this is also an economic inequality. So this is also an economic justice point. So climate crisis, we need to make it absolutely clear that this is not only just some technical point of some carbon particles. This is really a social justice issue. This is an economic justice issue. This is intergenerational justice issue. And this is like a colonial justice issue. So that understanding, we have to make it clearer and clearer, and we have to talk that it's not only about driving some electric cars or just starting to plant some trees in certain parts of the world. No, that's not going to solve. And yeah, this way of thinking was the main source of the problem, the crisis we are at. And even in Europe, the people who are do not have an affluent lifestyle, they are not the ones who contributed. So we have to be able to make the issue this clearer in this way, look at it in point by point and yeah, demystify it.
You work for an NGO, it's called Urgewalt. Can you describe your work there?
Urgewalt has been working already with the environmental issue for last almost now 30 years, like 92, Urgewalt started. So the focus of Urgewalt has always been to look at the corporate responsibilities to hold the big companies who have a lot of power, and then they do a devastating project that destroys environment and the communities, the indigenous people who lives closer to forest or different lands where they do mining and extraction or big even forestation projects, so kind of make those projects more visible and hold those companies more accountable and make them change their actions. So that has been Urgewalt's focus for all these years. And I work, one of the work that Urgewalt does is also to make the financing, all the money that goes into the fossil fuel sector that is driving the main climate crisis now. So to kind of make those connections clearer, because the problem or the shield that these big companies, these financial institutions have is it's very difficult to see actually who is doing what, where the money is going and how. These are oftentimes money from pension funds, money that our parents or even us, we pay into government pension funds, but then these government pension funds are investing in projects that are driving devastating projects in parts of India, in parts of Colombia, in parts of Bangladesh. So you see, like, even if I knew, I wouldn't want my money to be spent this way, right? But we cannot say, we don't know. It's a big confusing box, black box, this finance sector. And what Urgewalt, one of our projects, is to look into that sector and make those data available, that whose money is going where and what are the companies that are kind of involved in coal projects or this oil projects, this gas projects, and ask these big pension funds, this government, this financing institutions, that they don't keep putting money in those fossil fuel companies. So that's one part of our work. And I'm involved with this global coal exit list research team. We look into coal companies and research their annual reports and look into their data and kind of we list them. It's like a blacklist. And we ask these financing institutions that they don't put money in these companies anymore. So that's one part of my work. And I think it has a lot of leverage. It's one of the important points to tackle or to dismantle. So it has a lot of technical aspect, but at the same time, it has a lot of leverage, or how you say that, like a key point if you want to achieve or like have the change that we want to have in terms of moving away from the climate crisis.
And are you seeing that the companies are responding to it? Like if you say, hey, here's the list, that's the blacklist, don't invest here, are they happy to have it? Or
at the moment, with the whole pressure over the years, we see a lot of companies, a lot of financial institutions and investors ask for our list. They come to us and they wait. And even recently, we know that there were some big government pension funds were also considering that they were going to take this as a benchmark for all their investments. So in this way, we see that quite a bit of work is happening and there are progress. But at the same time, I personally feel, this is my personal position, that this is not happening fast enough. And we have been like doing it already for a while now. And yeah, we need to be faster. So that I really feel that this change needs to happen sooner. And it's not clearly happening fast enough. But there are changes and there are a lot of, yeah, these big government investment banks, even like AIIB. So they do respond to it and they change their policies. They change their actions responding to our campaign.
Do you work in other fields as an activist? Like I found that you work for Urgewalt. I wonder if there are, as you are an activist for climate justice, if there are other projects or other groups you work with.
Ah, yes. Yeah, of course. So for my outside of my professional work, as an activist, I'm part of the degrowth community for a really long time. So I have been working with that. I also, at the moment, we have this campaign going against a German company, Fischner, who are based in Stuttgart, and they are constructing a coal coal-based power plant in Bangladesh. And this coal power plant is very controversial because inside Bangladesh, there has been a movement for 9 years now because this coal power plant will destroy a forest. Actually, the forest is world's largest mangrove forest, and it is a World Heritage Site, UNESCO-listed World Heritage Site. And this movement has been going on, as I said, like for 9 years, and it's still going ahead. And from Germany, what we are trying to do to support the movement inside Bangladesh, that we create pressure on this German company, and we say no German company should be involved with such a project that threatens a forest and a World Heritage Site. So this is one of the projects also I'm very involved with, and I'm doing on my free time. And besides that, I'm also part of a BIPOC collective where we try to also address and work on, focus on how, like the BIPOC environmental activism. So from that, there's a lot of discussion and organizing. So there are several groups. And also I work closely with the Fridays. I have a very good relationship with the XR. So on different projects, I mean, of course, this is also not a big community. So we are friends, but we also often talk about different projects and kind of try to collaborate. Recently, I visited the Hambacher Forest, and we were also doing solidarity action from Hambi to the Sundarbans, and also visiting the villages that are part of the Alle Dörfer Bleiben movement and resistance. So yeah, these are all the other kind of work that I'm doing.
Do you ever feel like, I imagine it takes a lot of time, like that you feel, yeah, not burned out, but maybe a step before, or like that it's getting too much?
Yes, that of course also happened, because I think this is sometimes when you, yeah, if you sit and encounter the whole breadth of this whole crisis, then you really want to do, and you feel you cannot be without doing anything. Like I often, when people ask me like, why do you do it, or you're doing all these things, and I'm like, yeah, I do it because I cannot be without doing it. I cannot be happy. I cannot have fun, because the only way I can still be light and still be happy is I knowing that there is a crisis, this is my truth, and I'm trying to do with it, and I'm act on it. So I think that also in a way that helps me to stay sane. So I think a lot of my activism and work is actually acknowledging, owning my truth and working on it. That gives me a lot of strength. But of course, at the same time, I've had those moments when I was really like, there was a time when I was also, of course, working for my organization. And then on the side, I was working for the Fischner campaign, and it was, and also there were a few other things. Like it was also probably the same time when I was publishing the articles in TAS, and it was really like, I felt like, oh my God, I was like three person in one, and I was really completely crashing, and it was a very, very bad time. And then I realized, okay, I don't want to be there again, because it was really too much. I think what was worse, that I got a bit insensitive. Like I felt like I was being not so kind anymore. I was being like, I couldn't be as kinder to people. I was responding very short text to people, and I was thinking, hey, but this is not me. So I think then I realized, oh, okay, maybe I'm doing so much that I cannot even care anymore to be nice to people, or just like how I would love to. I would still love to be, you know, have this small soft interactions, but I was really like small text, not even responding to people for 5 days, and I'm coming back, ah, it's so mean. But you know, like I have had those like completely breaking, or like I realized, okay, that was actually not healthy, and then I decided to kind of balance better, and I'm trying to do better now. And of course people are also kind. They understood when I said I was going through a bad time, so they were also like, yes. And I think this is all this part of all the work that we do.
Mm-hmm. Teresa, like I talked to her in the second episode, and she said that you were doing a grief cycle. Can you explain what that is and what you do there?
It was actually, I think it was Teresa's idea. We were meeting 5 or 6 people in an intimate circle, and we wanted to talk and sit with the emotion of the grief, the ecological grief that we feel. And we present that to each other. So we sit with our own grief and allow our others to witness that. So I think that was the idea. We sat together. We all had a stone with us. And then we talked about how it makes us feel, the crisis and the emotions that arises within us as a result. And then we also, we shared with each other. We opened up and we sat with the emotion. That was basically the idea. And I think it was, in many ways, it was very powerful. As I was saying earlier to you, that for a while, and in 2017, I felt so lonely for a while, and it felt like my emotions were not valid, or how you say, like when you feel something and you don't see others responding or understanding it, you think, oh, what is wrong with me or something. So I think this circle was in many ways powerful to know that there are other people who are experiencing it in many different forms and degrees, but at the same time that they understand or see your emotion, and then at the same time, yeah, to be able to acknowledge it, to accept that grief, yeah, and to know that it's not crazy to feel that grief. It's actually absolutely probably the most normal thing, and we probably, most of us should, if we were looking, if we were connecting with our planet, we would probably, most of us would even feel, maybe we do, I think this is also another thing, maybe a lot of us actually feel that pain and grief because we are connected with this planet, and it's not nice to see all of these animals burning or all of these extreme climatic events happening. But many of us, we don't even know maybe that what it is that we feel and what's going on in our head.
Is there anything you would like to add?
I think what I feel more and more, most of us, we do feel sad when we see the news. Most of us, people always know the truth. Truth has this amazing power. And I think most people, we even know that our governments are not doing enough and that this is not right, what is happening with this planet. And this is absolutely self-destructive. I think most of us, we know it. But for most, we just don't know how to act, what to do with it. So for a lot of us, we try to avoid it because that's what we try to do, right? When there's something that bothers us, but we also don't know if I can do something about it, we just try to avoid and get on with our lives because otherwise we don't know how to deal with it. So I think maybe, yeah, a lot of us, the more and more of us try to not run away from these emotions and this truth, the more possible it will be, the faster it will be we can bring about a change. And maybe that's what we need. So I would say, whoever has some doubt, whoever thinks if climate activism is for me or if I should take a stand, I think, yes, definitely you should take a stand. Maybe you should start thinking or seeing how this makes you feel, or if there is even a tiny bit, like, not one or two person wouldn't save the world. All of us together, by doing a little, we would change things. And I think this is the time when we need the most, like if ever we need it, we need most everybody now. So I think I would want, yeah, whoever listening this to kind of reflect on that and think, what is the smallest way that you could get involved, could help, could support, and make a stand in this fight to protect our planet.
Thank you so much.
Welcome.
Thank you for listening to this episode and to my podcast. If you have any feedback, I'm happy if you write an email or if you write me on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. You will find all the profiles and the email address in the show notes as well. And there you will also find some linked articles, so have a look there. And if you like this episode, I'm happy if you share it with your friends or on social media. And don't forget to follow the podcast on social media so you don't miss the next episode.